This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
To quote the great legendary Canadian songstress Robin Sparkles, let's go to the mall today. Why the mall, you may ask? Because that's where comic book fans, oversexed teenagers, dope-smoking superheroes, and game show contestants will be. Now that sounds like a good time. It is, because Mall Rats is not that bad. Welcome, welcome, one and all, to It's Not That Bad, the podcast that looks for A grades in B movies. Now, we have said on this show that we have a love of Kevin Smith films. So it brings me great pleasure today to defend the one and only Mallrats. And here to raise the sword to defend with me from the Almost Famous Minute and Feels Like Weezer and Watchmen Minute podcast, Eric Nash is here for the first time. Eric, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, very good, Jason. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. Before we get started, and this is your first time here, please let our listeners know what your shows are about.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a big community of Movies by Minutes shows, podcasts, and I've completed one, and I'm in the middle of another, Watchmen Minute and Almost Famous Minute, and it's just looking at dissecting an entire movie, minute by minute. For each episode is 1 minute, and it's a pretty good discussions quite often, I feel like. And it's very detail-oriented, that's for sure. And that's the kind of guy I am.
Just little by little, nitpicking everything. That sounds really familiar, and I feel attacked at this point. But that's okay. But that's okay. But before we do get into this, what is it about Mallrats that made you want to pitch this movie to defend?
Oh, I mean, just right off the bat, as you mentioned, Kevin Smith, I've enjoyed almost all of his movies. There's been a couple, kind of less desirable ones, but certainly Clerks and Mallrats, the early ones, and Chasing Amy and Dogma, those are all great, and few and far between people I feel like you'd find that would say too much bad about any of them, except for Kevin Smith himself, who kind of often poo-poos on Mallrats. I think undeservedly, but that's the kind of guy he is.
I think that's more the self-deprecating humor on his point.
Oh, yeah.
But this is now, by the way, the third Kevin Smith film that we have defended on this show. Of course, we started with Jersey Girl, and we have gone down Yoga Hoser's road, but it brings me great pleasure to be able to once again watch Mallrats. So before we get into this, before we dive into the Viewisk universe once more, it is time to take Mallrats and trailerize it.
Determined men on a mission in the dangerous world of high-stakes consumerism. One man will attempt to win his girl back by sabotaging a game show and fomenting the collapse of a would-be media mogul. Another will attempt to rescue his lost love from the dangers of being in the back of a Volkswagen. Two will look to facilitate those goals through blunt force. And by that, I mean blunts and the force. And finally, one desperate soul will continue his journey, his life's quest, to see a sailboat. Along the way, they'll eat cookies, crash change rooms, and meet the man. All of this happens in one New Jersey day. It's like a New York minute, just on the other side of the tunnel. From the mind of Kevin Smith comes Mallrats, rated R for retail therapy.
There's a lot to unpack out of this one here, but let's get into who is in this film. The movie stars Jeremy London, Jason Lee, Shannon Doherty, Claire Forlani, Ben Affleck, Joey Lauren Adams, Renee Humphrey, Michael Rooker, Ethan Suplee, Jason Mewes, and of course, Kevin Smith. However, There is a huge, almost starring list for this film. So, Eric, I'm just going to toss a few names out here, and I'm going to get your reaction on this. Apparently, the studio wanted Seth Green to audition for the role of Jay. So yeah. Seth Green and Breckenmeyer both auditioned. And apparently Seth Green was on call, ready to jump in if ever need be. They, of course, stuck with Jason Mewes. But I cannot picture anyone else being Jay because Jay is Jay.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is, even though Clerks is in a sense the start of the Viewisk universe, it's really this movie that cements it. Yeah. And keeping Jay, I think, was a vital part of that. It's crazy to imagine that they really would have gone through with a recasting.
I mean, I can understand if the studio was worried, because, of course, you have to think around this time was probably, before Jason Mewes was completely clean of all drugs and whatnot. So, and not that we're ever behind the scenes, we know nothing. I'm just an idiot in a basement with a microphone here in Canada. But I can understand where the studio would want a backup plan. But thankfully, Jason Mewes is still in this one. For the role of Mr. Svenning, Brandy's father, it was originally thought of to be played by William Atherton, who of course was in Ghostbusters and Die Hard, but he turned it down because apparently it was like a, oriented for teens film. But the idea of William Atherton in that role is actually fascinating.
Yeah, that's one I didn't know. Yeah, thanks for educating me on this, because there's definitely these things that I'll be able to, I feel like, pitch in here with the I certainly knew the Seth Green thing, but William Atherton, that would have been pretty crazy.
When you think about his role as Walter Peck in Ghostbusters and of course Thornburg and Die Hard, like almost the perfect level of
authority
of,
level,
exactly, and just enough to be like the thorn in everybody's side. Like William Atherton was so much fun in those kind of roles, and I think he would have been good in this one. But and that's not taken away from Michael Rooker.
Oh no! Oh my God!
No, because we're talking Yondu here. You can't diss Yondu. In the role of Brody, as of course played by Jason Lee, you have to listen to this list here. This is a combination of who the studio suggested, who auditioned, and who was considered. And I'm just going to throw these names at one at a time. I'm going to get your reaction on this, Eric, okay? Mike Myers.
Wow. that doesn't seem right at all.
No.
I mean, I like him awfully well. I mean,
but just not in the role of Brody. No. Yeah. Adam Sandler.
Oh, my gosh. That's even worse. Yeah, in my mind. Wow.
Chris Farley.
I don't care for Sandler very well, but yeah.
Okay,
yeah, so we're going all on the same SNL. Page.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was studio suggestions at that point. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also auditioning was Steve Zahn.
Okay.
And under consideration was Mark Wahlberg. Okay. You're trying to picture that one now, are you?
Yeah, that's. I like the Steve Zahn. I feel like is the best so far, but
I mean, yeah, I could easily see Steve Zahn.
Yeah,
especially if you saw him in Sahara. Now, we're talking about a role that was horribly miscast. Steve Zahn should not have played that role in Sahara, but I think if you took that kind of performance and put it into Mallrats, it actually does make sense.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen Sahara, but just the other stuff I have seen of his, he's right there. He's a good second guy,
Oh, absolutely. Or if you think about his role in That Thing You Do, another great film.
Yeah. That's kind of what popped in.
Yeah. Just basically transport that character into this. I think it would have worked. In the role of T.S., and again, here's a combination of studio suggestions and people who were in the running or considered. Ethan Hawke, Henry Thomas.
Yeah, Henry Thomas, I'm liking Ethan so far.
And Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, wow.
I can't picture that one.
I mean, it's. I feel like it's a stretch right off the bat for like Ethan or Leo to have been working with Kevin Smith, but...
Well, I mean, keep in mind long ago this was, but yeah.
I mean, but we got it with Ben and Matt, so with their working with them at various points. I mean, mostly Ben, but
Apparently, also, Brian O'Halloran auditioned for the role of T.S. before he got cast as Gil Hicks. Now, in the role of Renee, the role was actually promised to Joey Lauren Adams before she was cast as Gwen. But instead of Joey Lauren Adams as Gwen, we almost had Parker Posey, who auditioned for that role. And I actually really like that one.
That would be interesting, yeah. Yeah, and you know, and the moving around of people as to their roles, you know, having one role but then kind of going to another, that certainly happened with, I'll let you know about for my other ongoing podcast, Almost Famous Minute, that, you know, New Girl lady, she was actually going to be Penny Lane for a bit. Or actually, maybe it was vice versa. Kate Hudson or Penny Lane I don't know why I'm blanking on the new girl name.
oh, you're thinking Zooey Deschanel.
Yeah, Deschanel. You know, they kind of had switched roles in a sense. You know, one or the other had the other's role for a moment, and then they kind of rejiggered it and got them into the proper roles. I certainly believe.
That's kind of like the idea of Tom Hiddleston originally auditioning for the role of Thor and then getting Loki. Right. So,
yep.
Now, we know, of course, that Renee was played by Shannon Doherty, but also in auditions was Alyssa Milano. And I'm a little surprised that Alyssa Milano has not yet actually been in a Kevin Smith film, because I have a feeling that she would have worked in this role as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I like how that works. Yeah.
Now, in the role of Trisha, as played by Renee Humphrey, apparently auditioning for the role was Jennifer Love Hewitt. And I feel at this point, we've basically taken everything from like 90210, Party of Five, and Charmed and thrown it all at Mallrats here. I don't know about Jennifer Love Hewitt in that role, though.
Yeah, and that's certainly got the tie-in with Ben there as well. That would have been interesting, but wow.
But also auditioning for both the role of Brandy and Renee were Kari Wuerer and Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah, Jenny McCarthy. I mean, yeah, she was hopping, I think, at this point, you know, that's for sure. But, wow.
Now, in the role of Brandy, of course, played by Claire Forlani, Lala Slopeman, who people will probably remember from Dream a Little Dream and Pump Up the Volume, was considered. But I can't picture that one. Cannot picture it at all. Now, also, according to IMDb, auditioning for roles in the film, but of course it didn't say who they were auditioning for, were Shawnee Smith, Heather Graham, and Reese Witherspoon. And like when you take a look at all the people who were either under consideration, suggested, or auditioned, like this is that's a who's who of Hollywood then and now.
Yeah, I feel like any of those could have worked pretty well. Yeah, that would have been very interesting. Mm.
And when you consider that, you know, release-wise, this, of course, is the follow-up to Clerks, that's got to say a lot about Clerks and how people reacted to that film for people to want to jump in on this. So kudos to Kevin Smith, who, of course, wrote and directed this. That being said, this film was given a dishonorable mention at the 1995 Stinkers Bad Movie Awards. It wasn't even in the top five, however, and, of course, no one was taking that Worst Movie Award for that year over Showgirls. However, however, when it was released on the October 20th, 1995 weekend, and all of a sudden I feel old just saying that, this movie debuted at number 13. 13. Now, the top film that week was the debut of Get Shorty, which came in at $12.7 million. Mallrats debuted with about $1.1 million. Now, it should be noted that it only debuted in 852 theaters, half the number of theaters that Get Shorty debuted in. So slight asterisk, but not enough, to get it up to that level. That being said, at number two was the debut of Now and Then. Number five was the debut of Never Talk to Strangers. So it was the lowest grossing debut film that weekend. And of course, that hurt the take on this one. The movie was made with a budget of $8 million and worldwide only made $2.1 million. And the reason why we're here, aside from the fact that you have pitched this film to talk about this, is the critics. Over at Metacritic, this film has a Metascore of 41. And over at Rotten Tomatoes, the audience score is 82%, which I kind of agree with. The Tomatometer, 58%. So it's one of the more borderline films that we've talked about. But of course, I don't think Kevin Smith is for the critics at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly I feel like there's a certain sense in Clerks that you know they liked there. There's something to it. This raw, but for a second outing, yeah, it's I feel like they had something much more, you know, respectable in mind that he would do, not something very comic booky and, you know, almost more juvenile in a way than Clerks was.
Well, I mean, I remember too, like watching the first An Evening with Kevin Smith, and he was talking about how, you know, what he had to do, and you know, with all the credit cards and whatnot in order to be able to make Clerks. Yeah. And then like, here's the studio saying, here's $8 million, go make Mallrats. It's like, what? Like, I get that. But that being said, there is an extended cut of this film, which is vastly different from the theatrical cut, to the point of there are apparently 100 differences between the original theatrical release and the extended version, including an entirely different opening. That's something to watch. I'll put it that way here. I'm going to ask you.
I don't think I've seen it in full, but for the style of podcast that I mainly do, the Movies by Minutes, the Jay and Silent Bob minute that I guested on, that is what they covered, was the extended cut version, however much more than a normal 90, you know, 100 minutes worth that Kevin's you know, theatrical cuts normally are. They kind of regretted, I feel like, having done that, you know, but they wanted, I think they wanted to be the couple guys that did that that Movie by Minute of Mallrats. They chose to do that, and I understand, but I feel like they would have kept their sanity a little bit better.
Well, when you realize that, you know, in a Movies by Minute format, you're on episode 30 before you get to the mall that extended cut.
Yep.
Like that's insane. Like, it's called Mallrats. Get to the mall. All right, let's get to the breakdown of this film. We're going to start with T.S. Quint as played by Jeremy London. So, Eric, how was Quint for you in this?
I mean, I actually kind of, you know, enjoy the character. It's not the greatest of all everyone that's here, that's for sure. I'm not going to put him, he's not going to be my VIP or MVP or what have you. I think you do in the show later on. But you know, he's pretty serviceable. I mean, the acting isn't top notch, but you know, the character itself, you know, he's fulfilling the right role. He's got a attitude about him that works for being for the plot and the dialogue written.
I think you nailed it right there. It's the dialogue.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
like with a Kevin Smith film, the characters speak in a very specific way, and the actors that work with Kevin Smith on a regular basis, they get where he's coming from with the dialogue, and they embody that dialogue. But I think in this case, Jeremy London didn't fit the dialogue, and it's a shame because, of course, like, you know, the majority of the film revolves around, of course, Quint and Brody. But I think for Jeremy London, it reminded me a little bit of, and I cannot remember the actor's name for the life of me. So when I explain who I'm talking about, you're going to know immediately. Dazed and Confused. Yeah. There's the kid with the long hair who keeps on touching his nose about 15 times in the film. Kind of reminds me of that performance a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I get that.
It's almost like in that uncomfortable in the shoes that you're wearing kind of performance. I think had, you know, the words maybe been tailored a little bit, or had you had a chance to, you know, play around with the role a touch, I think it could have worked. And I do think that the balance between him and Jason Lee worked as well, but it felt like he was almost struggling in the role.
Yeah, I certainly can get that. And, you know, but I still feel that, you know, there's just a little bit of an everyman to him. You know, he's not he's not too crazy acting. He does. I do feel like it centers the movie a bit fairly well. So I'm not totally down on him, but I'm not totally great with him either. You know,
I think the one thing that did get right though, you know, is that if you're going to have an actress like Claire Forlani in the role of Brandy, you need someone with the presence of a Jeremy London, I think, for the idea of Quint and Brandy as a couple to work. And I think in that case, they cast that couple very well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, yeah, and certainly that's something I've heard most associated with Lucas and the casting of Star Wars, that he really went for the chemistry between the various actors, and he found it with Mark and Carrie and Harrison.
Oh, absolutely. And even when you think about, you know, the pairing of Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson, that worked very well together. Maybe not so much Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen at the time, but, you know, Hayden Christensen's back. We're good with Hayden Christensen once again. It's all good. But let's move on to Brody, of course, played by Kevin Smith's favorite Jason Lee. How was he in this role for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we're getting kind of, I feel like, the top notch. You know, it's cementing, you know, Jason Lee as a Kevin Smith guy, you know, that he'll come back to after this again and again. Yeah, he's got this bravado attitude that he really has some good almost monologues. And that's going a little bit to my Almost Famous minute where he's the lead singer of the band, of the fake band in it. And he definitely gets some monologues there too, that Cameron Crowe really does well for him. But, you know, it's not just the monologues, but it's just the back and forth attitude. You know, he does it so well, even when he's with someone like Jeremy London doing a lot of the dialogue.
You have to think that, you know, in writing this character, this was maybe like Kevin Smith's alter ego, if the alter ego was cool. And I'm not saying Kevin Smith isn't cool. I'm just saying that, you know, if you're ever going to envision what cool would be, Brody kind of fits that mold, that mold of what do you think Kevin Smith would think cool is. Knows all his comics, smart, quippy, witty, you know, just a ton of fun. Just an absolute ton of fun. And I think, you know, when you think about the trajectory, Jason Lee really did kind of take off from this. You know, of course, following this was My Name is Earl, as well as a bunch of other Kevin Smith films. Like, Jason Lee got it. He really got what this film was about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It also kind of fit in with that whole 90s era philosopher, right? The cool guy who has all these great poetic thoughts on how life should be. And, you know, I remember when we did the episode on Dog Park, and we kind of got into that thought process of the 90s philosopher role. Brody is definitely the 90s philosopher in this.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Even more so than what I was trying to indicate with the monologues and so forth. But yeah, that attitude of, you know, of that he's pontificating, you know, the various ideas and way things should be and so forth.
It was almost like every 90s philosopher had a metaphor for everything that made sense. And when you think about movies like, you know, Reality Bites and Empire Records and Singles, like there was a complete string of, you know, aimed at the late teens, mid 20s era, you know, 90s film goer. And how many people will sit there and quote movies of that era with their own idea of life philosophy? I think there was a lot of introspection in the writing in that era. Moving on, Claire Forlani, who played Brandy. Now, keep in mind, this is only her third movie role. Her first film, Gypsy Eyes, has a 0% audience score. Her second film, Police Academy Mission to Moscow, has a 0% tomatometer. So we're moving up in the world with this one?
Yeah.
But how was she for you?
And for her, I feel like that's even more right on. You know, it's I don't know. It's just there's, again, it's just this correct, very good attitude coming from her that, you know, she's not going to take, you know, if I can curse just a little bit, the you can bleep it out, I suppose, I forget if you do that or not. But yeah, she doesn't take it, and she'll give it back even too.
I mean, she plays Brandy as smart and caring, just not in the way that Quint would like as far as the caring side goes. But the thing is, Claire Forlani is a phenomenal actress. All you have to do is go watch the movie Antitrust to go see that, which, again, another one of those movies that will qualify and we will talk about eventually. It's actually on our coming soon page on notthatbadcast.com. We will one day get to that film and tackle that one here. But I think, in the same way that Jeremy London, I don't think, was feeling the dialogue in this, there were times when Brandy wasn't feeling the dialogue. But I will say, when you take a look at the two different openings, the theatrical cut where T.S. just shows up to pick her up for their trip to Florida, and she's talking about the girl who had the embolism, when T.S. mentioned that the camera's put on 10 pounds, as opposed to the, almost very slapsticky, musket on a rooftop opening in the extended cut. I think she actually did better in the extended cut opening than she did in the theatrical cut opening. Moving on, we now get to the role of Renee as played by Shannon Doherty. When you think about Shannon Doherty, this is, to me, aside from 90210 and aside from Charmed, to me, this is the role that I think of when I think of Shannon Doherty. So how was she in this for you?
Yeah, I mean, and Shannon, she does great, I think. And I like barely ever watched in either of those shows. It's definitely this that I know her from. She's doing some good work here, I think, too. It's nothing to be down about, as far as I can tell.
I think the fun thing, too, with this role is that it's almost like meta-comedy for her. It's probably one of the things where, as soon as they realized that they had Shannon Doherty for the role, it's like, okay, we're going to change the script a little bit, and we're going to actually have a little bit of fun with her popularity on 90210. Of course, they make the Brenda joke in the movie, but I love the fact that she actually had fun with it. I think that that's almost endearing, in her performance in this. Let's get back to the Svenning family here, and Michael Rooker, who played, of course, Brandy's father. We talked about William Atherton and the idea of putting him into this role, but let's get to the person who did have it, Michael Rooker. How was he for you?
That definitely would have been one way to go, William Atherton. I mean, it would make a lot of sense. But then Michael Rooker, you got a whole different kind of attitude for him, I feel like, that he brought to it. That, he's a little more grizzled, I feel like, is probably a good word. And he's a little more, on the mean side, not just to be mean, but to really get a job done. Seems like he's just really, really just trying to, do his work and care for his family. I feel like that's there.
I think the nice thing too is that he plays the foil well, and the fact that he does all this in order to try to stop Brandy from going to Florida with TS. He probably had an inclination, the talk of them going to Florida was happening. He probably had an inclination that he might try to propose or something like that. So it makes sense that he tried to pull something like this off. And I think in that sense, the idea of, asking Brandy to help with the show, it's a little meddling. And I think that kind of fits. I feel like we've been picking on Michael Rooker a little bit on this show lately, because of course we did recently talk about him in Days of Thunder. But, enjoying him in that role, he does play gruff very well. And I think the thing is, whereas William Atherton probably would have brought the snark, I think, or at least the smarmy media mogul idea, I think the idea of Michael Rooker as a much more intimidating father figure worked better in this case.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Yeah, And Michael Rooker, I mean, the thing I probably know him best, I always kind of would point out to people that, hey, he's like the one of the second, third hand guy in the office for JFK. You know, that's one of the earlier things he did, I feel like. You mentioned Days of Thunder, and apparently, yeah, that's right about the same time even too. But yeah. Doing great.
See, I make it a rule of thumb never to mess with anyone who is in the Belko experiment, which if you've seen that film, A, phenomenal film, but B, don't mess with anyone in the Belko experiment. Ben Affleck, Batman himself, as Shannon Hamilton, kind of a smarmy guy in this one here, but I think he kind of works. Did it work for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so yeah. So this is, you know, coming off of, you know, the Dazed and Confused that you mentioned before for other reasons, but yeah, I mean, you know, it made a lot of sense that Kevin Smith would get with him and cast him as in this role, and this not leading role. You know, he's not leading yet, but you know, he's playing a kind of the, you know, one of the two bad guys, main bad guys. You know, the kind of, you know, it works well that there's each of the guys, the father and the fashionable male employee.
And that's the thing. I think, you know, for TS, it made sense to have Michael Rooker as the nemesis, the very imposing father figure. For here, Shannon is the complete antithesis to Brody, right? Brody is the comic book loving Sega NHL playing Go Hartford Whale. You know, like, he's that guy. Right. And Shannon Hamilton is the complete opposite of that. You know, he's the jock, the prep, the frat boy. Right. He's the guy in the designer clothes and the slick back hair. And, you know, it's all about perception. Whereas Brody is like, come as you are, hang and have a good time. So I think the balance works well. And I think Affleck really kind of leaned into this one here. It like really took on that frat boy vibe.
Yeah, that's definitely a good way to put that. Yeah, he is very kind of slick, but also, you know, like I said, he's playing with one of the bad guys here.
Yeah, and the thing is, Affleck plays him in a way that you're not supposed to like Shannon. You're not, and you don't. You absolutely don't. So, you know, mission accomplished. You know, we've said on this show a number of times, you know, if you're not supposed to like the actor, or at least the character, and you end up sitting there, you know, really disliking the actor because of the character,
yeah,
the actor did a phenomenal job. Affleck really nailed the unlikableness of Shannon Hamilton. But let's get to the supporting cast here. We have Joey Lauren Adams, who, of course, played Gwen, another Kevin Smith fave, and, of course, you know, the next one being Chasing Amy, which, of course, had Affleck and Jason Lee and Joey Lauren Adams. Like, this obviously set that up. But Joey Lauren, it's a smaller role, but how was Gwen for you?
Yeah, so Joey as Gwen is doing a pretty good job. You know, I definitely like her better. I feel like in Chasing Amy, that character, it works. It's much more suited to her. But here, yeah, I mean, she's being used pretty well. You know, for a good bit of some good comedic bits and so forth. But yeah, it's and you know, the thing here is that, you know, they apparently, you know, kind of during, after, you know, around the time of this movie is when the two of Kevin Smith and Joey started dating, you know, and, you know, had a short relationship supposedly, but then still went on to make Chasing Amy together, you know, so seemingly very amicably ended relationship. But, you know, yeah, she, you know, her role is great. Yeah.
I think the key thing about Gwen is that not only does she humanize Brandy with their friendship, but I think she also humanizes TS a little bit, because, of course, TS and Gwen used to go out together until it broke up. And, of course, Gwen is using that connection while talking to Brandy to point out how good TS and Brandy work. Like, Gwen is almost the anchor point for these two in showing why they work well together.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Gwen has a purpose. The purpose is to make sure that the couple gets back together. Renee Humphrey as Trisha, or Trish the Dish. A tad uncertain at times in the role again for me, but I think she was well cast for this.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and it's, I feel like this is probably one of the tougher roles for anyone, you know, playing this character, this young character amongst the group, I feel like, if I'm right, the 15-year-old, but doing this experiment, journaling, so forth, to be published, you know, on sex for, you know, that's happening amongst, you know, teenagers and early 20 somethings, or all, I guess all the way up to the 30-ish age, I believe, even too.
Her coding system is straight up laughable and fun. There are times where I think the extended cut actually benefited the character of Trish. Of course, there's this one moment when Trish drops off the VHS tape to Jay in order to be able to sabotage Shannon. But at that point, LaForce is looking at the rope that Silent Bob is hanging from, and she goes and intercepts LaForce in only the way Trish can. But I think it's one of those things where this is one of the characters that benefited from the longer, more, you know, the side characters got more room to play with. So if you haven't seen the extended edition of Mallrats and you like the role of Trish, go watch that, because there's more of her, and I think it benefits the character more. But I still think even in the theatrical cut, the role works well. I can see why Jennifer Love Hewitt would have auditioned for the role, especially when you realize that Jennifer Love Hewitt would eventually go on to be in the client list. So it's kind of foreshadowing. Let's move on to Ethan Suplee, who, of course, played William, the man who couldn't see the sailboat. Fun little side character here, but how was it for you?
Yeah, so he really comes in and I think does a good job for, I forget if he really kind of continues on from here in this role, or the role kind of continues on by anyone even, but it is a continuation of the character in Clerks. The Snowball character, who was played by the Kevin Smith friend and producer Scott Mosier. So what Ethan Suplee is doing here is, I feel like, really good, comedic work. And you know, he goes on to do other great stuff, and one with Jason Lee as a very good sidekick in that My Name Is Earl show.
Mm-hmm. By the way, he also did play William again in Clerks 3. So okay, there is that. But of course, he's also the voice of the Golgothan in Dogma.
Yeah.
And he appears as a teen in Clerks 2. So, you know, his time working in the Viewisk universe was definitely not over with this film. And the fact that the character does come back, that's awesome. But it's one of those little things where Kevin Smith has the ability to create this wonderful cast of side characters, and they don't necessarily always play directly into the main plot, but they make like a nice little, for lack of a better term, side quest, you know, just a little breather for comedic relief, and to just, so you're not constantly pushing the plot forward. Every now and then you have to have a moment where you can kind of stop and enjoy the moment for a second here. Ethan Suplee, I think, is that in this. He's that nice little pit stop on the road to the end of the plot. And it's so memeable. Like when you think about Mallrats, I think this character is the most memeable of many of Kevin Smith's characters.
Yeah, definitely, you know, him standing there looking at the Magic Eye poster and having problems with it, and other characters coming in and giving him a hard time and all that kind of stuff is pretty awesome.
I still love the fact that, you know, at the end when they're doing one of those, you know, what did the characters do after this film? And, you know, they finally get to him. It's like, you know, William finally saw the sailboat. He just looks at the camera and goes, yeah? I was like, oh, I loved it. It was brilliant. Priscilla Barnes, who was Miss Savannah, the fortune teller in the dirt mall. How much did you chuckle at this scene?
Oh yeah, I mean it's kind of these one like again it's kind of another this is almost more of a side quest, you know. It involves the main characters needing to go do a little thing on the side, try to figure out some stuff, and you know, going to a topless fortune teller, you know, it's just, you know, silly beyond belief. I mean, I don't know if those things actually is a real thing out there anywhere. I mean, maybe after this, but I don't know if Kevin Smith just came up with it on his own. But and then you know, getting this actress, I think really worked out well. That she does a really good job as in dealing with these two knuckleheads.
I'm going to put this out there as a. Probably thinking way too deeply about a character with a third nipple, but bear with me on this one here. When you take a look at the hero's journey, like the model for most storytelling when it comes to popular fiction, you know, by the time T.S. and Brody get to the dirt mall, the flea market, they've hit the abyss. They've hit that point where you've absolutely hit rock bottom. You're out of the mall, you're somewhere else, and you're talking to a topless fortune teller for some kind of redirection here. The next step in the hero's journey is transformation. And Miss Savannah is the perfect transformation point in this. And I can't believe I'm comparing, you know, I'm putting the mall rats into the hero's journey, but yet here we are. When you take a look at the way the hero's journey, you know, is supposed to go, Miss Savannah is almost necessary in this.
You changed my mind there on that. Yeah, me kind of downgrading it to side quest, but yeah, you're right. That does make a lot of sense, and she does a really good job. I feel like, yeah,
we cannot talk about this film without talking about the man himself. Stan Lee in one of his best cameos of all time. No, this does not put this into the MCU as much as you want to put Mallrats into the MCU because Stan Lee is there. But his performance in this, I freaking loved it. But how was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I even almost find it hard to call it a cameo. I mean, I know it was just a day's work or whatever. You know, they said, you know, whatever you do here is going to be great. You know, we're going to love it. But he's playing himself and in so many of those other Marvel cameos and you know, even though they've kind of said, oh, maybe he's kind of playing the same character throughout them all. You know, in those quite often are all these kind of various jobs that he's doing in those roles. But this, I mean, he's playing himself. Yeah. So that makes it kind of feel a little bit like a cameo, but it's something that's very important to the plot to again, just doing something very similar to what the fortune teller was doing.
I don't know. I do think Stan Lee is one of the watchers. You know, that's how he's able to witness everything.
Yeah.
But also, if you go back and watch Captain Marvel and Stan Lee's cameo in that, he's holding the copy of the script of Mallrats. So maybe Mallrats is MCU. Maybe it's canon. I do want to believe that. But the thing is, Stan Lee's, you know, his moment in this, his story moment in this, it's almost as powerful, I think. Actually, I would say it's more powerful than in Chasing Amy when Silent Bob goes on his absolutely long rant story kind of thing. And there's those moments where you meet that character and that's the turning point. Whereas Miss Savannah was T.S.'s turning point, this was Brody's turning point as well. This was his transformation period. Mm-hmm. Brian O'Halloran as Gil Hicks. Now, apparently Gil is a cousin of Dante. So yes, Viewsk Universe, it works. But how much fun was it to have Brian O'Halloran in this, knowing the impact and how well he did in Clerks?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not, yeah, certainly not as big a role as that lead in that was. You know, it was fun at the time. I feel like when I initially saw this back when I was in college in the late 90s, and, you know, seeing that, okay, that was him, that was the same, oh, it's the same guy, but he's playing a different character. But you know, later on, I mean, you know, it's relegated to almost the same kind of role as the other friends of Kevin Smith's that are especially earlier on were so often in his movies. His local friends from New Jersey. I listened to their podcasts, the Walt Flanagan and Brian Johnson and a few other people too, of course, but Tom, Steve, Dave, which got its name from this appearance that they have in here. But you know, it's kind of, you know, it seems like he's relegating Brian to that similar kind of level of, okay, we're going to have him back and he'll do this less important character.
And I think that's one thing that Kevin Smith does very, very well with all of his films is that bringing back some of those familiar actors as a wonderful anchor point for fans of the Viewisk universe. Like even in, you know, Jersey Girl, which wasn't the most well received of his films, which I still think it's a gem, and that's mainly because of George Carlin. But you know, you have those moments and those actors pop up, and it's like, oh no, it's still a Kevin Smith film, and that's good. And you know, whether you like his films or not, Adam Sandler is very good at that as well, casting his friends, bringing back the same familiar people, so that even if you're not enjoying the Adam Sandler film, happens. You enjoy when the regular cast of characters come back. And I think it's that, and Tarantino again also does the same thing, right? Like it's very much this work with your friends mentality, and it's almost comforting, I think, to the viewer.
Yeah, definitely. And like I say, you know, while I feel like he's moved on a bit, you know, like you mentioned Jersey Girl, sure. There's some there, but that is what now a kind of old movie. But in some of his more recent stuff where he's gone, done the Red State and Tusk and Yoga Hosers, you know, he's kind of gotten another, you know, at least there's definitely the one big one that I note from those is Ralph Garman, who is his one of his many podcasts that he used to do, kind of, I feel like, at this point, co-host there, the Hollywood Babylon co-host.
Oh yeah. And that's the thing, like when you have the ability to work with your friends and just have that much fun filmmaking, it needs to be applauded. Now, I can't believe we are at this point in the podcast and we're only now getting around to talking about Jay and Silent Bob in this. But I think this is the film. Like, yes, they were in Clerks, but I think this is the film that cemented Jay and Silent Bob as the characters that they were going to be. And how was, you know, compared the two, Jay and Silent Bob in this and then Jay and Silent Bob in Clerks, which one worked better for you?
I feel like, yeah, their roles in the first one was better from a purely comedic point of view, from purely, you know, oh, we got these couple kind of almost losers in a sense. Maybe, you know, I feel like a lot of people would describe them, you know, hanging around and just being knuckleheads. But in this one, they do bump it up a good notch, and that continues forward where they play an even more and more important role in the outcome, the plots of the movies. But you know, it's there's always the issue with Silent Bob not really being that silent at some point, and you know, in Clerks he definitely gives a nice little monologue, but you know, in this one he's doing so much more throughout, I feel like, you know, than, like I said, more integral to the plot. But you know there's like half of them when they are in Kevin Smith's movies, because they're not always in his movies, all of his movies. But Silent Bob, you know, half the time, roughly, he speaks and says something really important. The other half, it's just something kind of non sequitur, you know, just off the cuff and seemingly off the cuff and so much more for comedic effect.
I just keep picturing this moment in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And, you know, the sign on the back of the car says Critters of Hollywood. Like, again, every now and then you need that character to snap. But I mean, you think about it, right? I mean, Penn and Teller have done that shtick their entire career together, oh, yeah. Right? And, you know, here, it works very, very well. I often think of Jay and Silent Bob, and I can't believe I'm comparing Kevin Smith to Shakespeare, but here we go. Jay and Silent Bob are the modern-day Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And I think you need those kind of characters in films that have a decently large cast and a lot going on. You need those characters for levity, companionship, and almost a grounding for everything else that goes on around them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also related right back to, again, Star Wars. It's the 3PO and R2-D2, you know, they're kind of the background ish, but through line of the whole thing.
C-3PO and R2-D2, Statler and Waldorf, like the idea of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern-esque characters in properties is a mile long, but I think Jane, Silent Bob fit into that characterization very well. There you go, everyone. I have compared Kevin Smith to Shakespeare successfully, I think, here. Let's take a look, though, at Kevin Smith's filmography for a second here. Obviously, Mallrats, because we're talking about it on this show, the critics kind of, you know, poo-pooed on it kind of thing, but critics are whatever. But when it comes to the View Askewniverse itself, how does Mallrats rank for you?
It's fairly high, but, you know, because essentially the Jay and Silent Bob movies themselves, those are on the lower end for me. I haven't rewatched them too much. And even Clerks 2, and I still have, I'm not as big of a fan. I have not watched the Clerks 3 yet. It came out last year now, at least about a year ago or more. I feel like there's a big, really big tie for number one for me between Clerks and Dogma, but it comes in there respectably, I think, you know, middle to high.
I mean, I still hold Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back in very high regard, but that's just me. Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, not so much. I completely agree. Clerks 2, I liked it. I liked it a lot. I'm not gonna lie. Mallrats, though, to me, it's definitely probably about 3 or 4 because there's a lot of fun in this. Clerks 3, while I completely appreciate what that movie is, it can be a little hard to watch. I'm not going to spoil it for you. Just go and watch it if you like Kevin Smith films. But it can be a little hard to watch. But I think this is the film that established not just the idea of the 90s philosopher as well, but I think it established the ability for Kevin Smith to write visual comedy as well as dialogue-driven comedy. And there's a difference, right? Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is more the physical, not necessarily Keystone Cops, but definitely the more slapsticky type humor. Clerks being the very dialogue, cerebrally driven humor. Mallrats, I think, is the perfect middle ground of those two types of comedy.
Yeah, I definitely get that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's... Yeah, 4 or 5-ish for me.
It's not Tusk, and that's the main thing here.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so it has come time. So, Eric, who is your MVP of 1995's... Oh, I'm getting old just saying that. Mallrats.
I feel like you probably can guess, but Jason Lee. I really believe so. It's just starting that trend for him. Of what he goes on to be even better, but you know, it's a good, great first, really great first start, you know, right off the bat, take on this irascible kind of, you know, like you said, philosopher is a great word. I feel like there's a quality about his, you know, acting, you know, and coming so, you know, new on the scene. From skateboarding previously, you know, that, you know, he does so well at it. It's amazing that Kevin Smith found him, I believe.
Okay. So before I mention my MVP, I need to give a shout out to Stan Lee. The dearly departed Stan Lee. Like, this to me despite all of his cameos in the various MCU films, despite all any of his voiceover roles in various properties, even in DC properties like Teen Titans Go, I have to give it to Shannon Doherty. I think there's something about Renee in this that, A, it's my favorite Shannon Doherty performance. B, I think it really cemented her as not taking herself too seriously, especially when you consider some of the meta humor in this. Like, I love when an actor can laugh at themselves and have fun with it. I think Renee was a wonderful character. Again, a little bit of 90s philosopher in there when you think about her whole monologue about crying in the bathroom. But at the same time, worked so well with Jason Lee. And as I mentioned, with Jeremy London and Claire Forlani being perfectly cast as a couple there, I think in this case as well, Jason Lee and Shannon Doherty would cast perfectly against each other. And it works well that there are MVPs. Eric, thank you. Thank you so much for this. Before we go, I want to give you the mic. Again, let our listeners know about your shows and where they can find you out there on the interwebs.
So Watchmen Minute was the first one that I did, completed, and we actually, at the end of doing the director's cut there, 186 minutes, 186 plus episodes, because we also then, right when we were finishing it, essentially was when the Watchmen show came out, so we did episode by episode for that. So if you're interested in that as well, you can just check out the last 9 or 10 episodes from that feed. Then Almost Famous Minute and Feels Like Weezer, they're both on the podcast network I'm on, is Pantheon Podcast, and it's all about various music shows, mostly music, and it's actually the network you're on now too, right?
I was about to say, like, there's a couple shows on there that our listeners might be familiar with, this one and There Can Only Be One. By the way, if you're ever looking at doing a Movies by Minute on the Zack Snyder's Justice League, you have my empathies already, because that's a long, long film. Eric, thank you so much for this. And you have an empty chair waiting for you whenever you are ready to come back again. Yes.
I do have a few more movies that I've realized, that's a good one. That's a good one I've lined up.
The microphone is always ready for you, so anytime. Now, dear listeners, you guys know the drill. If there is a movie out there that you think is unfairly maligned or just so bad that there's no way in New Jersey that we can find anything bad to say about it, hit us up on Twitter at Not That Badcast or on any other social media at Not That Badcast. Is it still Twitter? We'll call it Twitter. Forget Elon. Or you can go to our website at notthatbadcast.com. And while you're there, make sure you check out the Coming Soon page and all of our other shows that are also all available on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Until next time, Eric, thank you so much. Listeners, you guys are awesome. This is It's Not That Bad. Take care.